My name is Eric Jorsted, and this is the third in our series, Community, Crimes, and Justice. Our topic today is called Punishment versus Reconciliation, as a look at the goals of criminal sentencing. The best place to start is with a little bit of a review of what we've done so far, not assuming that everybody here has been through all of the sessions. I'm glad to see a more reasonable number of people here, that we're actually all in chairs and so on, because maybe I can start to get to know the faces a little better and to know just who's here and who isn't. In our first session, we looked at the question of what causes crime, and we found that it's tough to answer because there are so many different types of crimes that you can't peg down any one. And say this is what crime is. Everything from treason to tax evasion to armed robbery are all crimes. But we started to put some sources of crimes on the board, and we found that there are sources that have to do with individual motivation that we called human nature, and that there are sources which have to do with the way society is put together, poverty, racism, and so on. The former are traditionally the conservative answer to what causes crime, and the latter, the liberal. And we kind of agreed that we need both if we're going to understand what really causes crimes. And we finally talked a little about our own experiences of being victims of crimes. The second session, last evening, we talked about how the justice system works, or more aptly, how the justice system does not work. From the key which turns the ignition, namely a call to the police, to the exhaust that comes out of the engine, which you might call people who finally get shuffled out of prison. And we looked at why reforms have not worked for the criminal justice system. And we found that the system has enormous political pressures put on it, that there's economic bias that's built into the system, and that the system itself only deals with the failures, with the people who have already committed crimes, and so can't be effective in fact, reducing crimes. It only deals with the kind of misfits who already work their way through it, into the system. And finally, we pretended that we had a health hazard in Holden Village, namely a contaminated water supply, and we tried to figure out how we would solve the problem. And we came up with roughly the three ways that public health officials solve contamination problems, which is to treat the victims of it, which is to inoculate or to harden the people who are not yet victims so they don't get it, and thirdly, to get at the root causes, the source of the contamination. And those three ways, in fact, correspond to three ways of trying to reduce crimes, namely dealing with the individuals who commit crimes, dealing with the root causes of what causes crime, and thirdly, denying criminals opportunity in terms of locked doors, neighborhood watches, watching out for each other, and so on. So that's where we've gotten ourselves to today. Today will, I suspect, be the one that we're going to have the most debate about. So far, there's been a general kind of consensus, at least I haven't gotten a whole lot of opposition. In this group or meeting with you personally, as we've been talking around the village, I suspect that what we have to cover today is going to generate a little bit more discomfort. It's going to be a little harder to talk about. And I'll be surprised if we don't disagree about what we have to look at today. And that is, what do we do with criminals? What do we do with people who have been caught, for one thing, they've been convicted for another, and now it's up to us, the wise, sincere, moral, and beneficent legislators and judges of society, to decide what to do with these people who have evaded their taxes, who have kidnapped our children, who have sold secrets to the Soviets, etc. What do we do with these kinds of people? And the way I've set this up for this morning is in terms of a confrontation. I noticed that on the board the calligrapher changed slightly my notation. I had punishment v. reconciliation, trying to use the legal terminology. If you read legal cases, that's the way it's put, and trying to set up an adversarial approach. They changed it to verses, so it looks a little more like what you expect if you're not a lawyer, but that's what we want to do, is set up two very different ways of looking at it and see which are the strengths and weaknesses of each. First, let's start with the philosophy of punishment. And to start with, I'd like to read a passage that if you've been in the village for a couple days, you've already heard. If you've been here more than a couple days, you've heard it a few times. This was the second lesson last Sunday, at least part of it. For the Lord trains the ones that he loves, and he punishes all those that he acknowledges as his sons. A couple verses later. Besides, we have all had our human fathers who punished us, and we respected them for it. We ought to be even more willing to submit ourselves to our spiritual father to be given life. Our human fathers were thinking of this short life when they punished us and could only do what they thought best. But God does it all for our own good so that we may share his own holiness. Of course, any punishment is most painful at the time and far from pleasant. But later, in those on whom it has been used, it bears fruit in peace and goodness. That's Hebrews chapter 12, verses 6 and 9 to 11. According to this passage, why should we punish somebody? Let's start by opening it up to the group and get your input. Why should somebody be punished? What does punishment accomplish? Maybe that's a better way to put it. According to this passage.
It brings peace. It's for their own good. Isn't that what it implies?
It's for their own good is what it implies. Mm-hmm. So it's for the good of the person who's being punished is what punishment accomplishes. Just what does it do to the one who's being punished?
You said it hurts them momentarily, but then it helps them later on. So it's just a kind of sting and everything. I don't know, it just helps them.
Well, when I get stung by a bee, it hurts for a time.
Yeah.
And later on it feels better again. But I'm not sure I've learned a moral lesson. What's different about punishment? I mean, how does punishment accomplish it? What does the pain do?
The pain teaches them not to do it again, so it teaches them a bit of a lesson.
But it doesn't work that way.
To do it? What is the it? Pain teaches them not to do what again?
Maybe they get caught.
They got punished for.
Whatever they got punished for. They got caught. Yeah.
Hopefully it produces change.
Produces change.
It,
yeah.
It should.
Well, there's a presupposition. Well, okay, go ahead, Jenny.
Well, if the punishment is in relation, in a kind of a natural consequence sort of thing for what was done, like when you touch a hot stove, you know you get burned and you're not going to touch it again. If the punishment is in some kind of relationship to what you did,
mm-hmm.
then you may learn from it. If the mm-hmm. punishment has no relationship to what was seen as being done wrong, then it's not going to have that kind of.
It sounds like result. A parent. This sounds like a parent talking.
Yeah, it is.
And as one who has a baby who's just starting to learn what no means, where she now will take a mouthful of dirt and hold it up to her mouth, and then look at you with a smile, waiting for you to say no. Then you say no, and she grins and puts it in her mouth.
And she's going to learn, that just doesn't feel very good in my mouth. I'm not going to want to do that.
Well, hopefully that will outweigh the pleasure of putting us doing.
Where sometimes children aren't permitted to experience the consequences mm-hmm. of action, but intervention always takes place first.
Mm-hmm.
Then that learning doesn't take place.
So punishment has to do with learning. There's something educative about punishment. And what it presupposes is that as human beings, we don't like pain, and that we're going to avoid whatever causes us pain. And so if somebody does something, you punish them for it, they'll not do it again if that pain becomes associated with that action. That's kind of what punishment presupposes. In a kind of simplistic sense, it's like Maslow's bell. When you ring the bell and the dog salivates, First because you brought the food, but later just because you heard the bell. You associate in your mind, in that case, pleasure with a certain action, but through punishment, it's pain with a certain action. Psychologists call that behavior modification. And whether it took B.F. Skinner did not invent it. Obviously, the writer to the letter of the letter to the Hebrews knew something about what punishment could accomplish. There's one other factor in the equation. What does punishment do to the one who punishes? There's two. It takes two to punish. It takes one who is punished, and it takes one who does the punishing. What does it do for the punisher?
What does it do for him, or what does it take?
Well, both.
Okay. In the case of a parent, it takes love sometimes to punish. All right? Now, that's different with the state. Oh, but hopefully it would not be different, but I think often.
Well, if you give someone the power to punish, you have to suppose that they're going to use that power wisely.
Yeah.
That they really know what's good for the person that they're doing it to. Because what happens if you punish someone unwisely? Or harmfully? Mm-hmm. Yeah, go ahead.
I spoke to a lawyer once, and this was a sociable type place it was. And I said, well, why are you always at a very out-of-the-way place and sort of away from the limelight? And he said, because somebody is looking for me.
Hmm.
See, apparently he had the power at the time to gave somebody a sentence or put them in prison, and now he's a little bit leery about if anything should happen after.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's where the punisher pays a price for inflicting the punishment, or as a potential price. In the possibilities of rebellion. What if the person doesn't learn their lesson? What if the lesson they learn is just that this person's hurting me? I don't like this person who's hurting me. As soon as I have the chance, I'm going to do something to this person who's hurting me. Or not just person, say it's the state personified. The government is hurting me. I don't like it. My first chance, what am I going to do back? That's another lesson that could be learned from punishment. Go ahead.
The punisher also has some needs met.
Hmm. Could say a little more.
The passage you showed, our fathers punished us at their pleasure. All of us who find it necessary to punish our children, if we're honest, also meet some of our own needs.
Mm-hmm.
It isn't necessarily good, but it's there.
Yeah, well, both good and bad. In the good sense, I think there's a reinforcement of moral order. Or at least order, if it's not moral. But ideally, as one who punishes or disciplines a child, you think that you're reinforcing a moral order, and that it feels good to know that what you're doing is to the benefit in the long run. But on the negative side, there's certainly a potential for what? Sadism? For inflicting pain? I mean, to think that you're justified in inflicting pain on another person certainly has potential for danger. Even if it's for their good in the long run, especially if you think it's for their good in the long run. Well, I see two hands. Go ahead.
I always think that it's twice as hard as a parent to punish a child than it is for the child.
And
I've experienced both ends.
Yeah. One would always hope that the punisher feels that. That says that the punisher has got the kind of humility about their own actions. That avoids some of the worst possible dangers of inflicting pain. I saw a hand up here first.
I don't like the word punishment. I think it only leads to resentment and hate. It should be discipline that leads to self-discipline. That's not necessarily punishment.
Okay.
Which translation did you use? I
looked through several to find the one that said punish.
Okay.
Because New English Bible says train.
Okay, I like
Revised
that.
Standard Version says discipline.
Okay.
And this was the one read, I think it was Saturday or Sunday, which says punish. And it's the one that leapt out at me and made me write a note right away. Use this on Wednesday, because okay. it's the one that brings it up. Go ahead.
We're talking about punishing criminals, right? Not just children.
Well, I'm going to get to the connection here in a second, but go ahead.
Okay, no, I'm not talking about children. I'm talking about criminals. I feel there can't be indifferent punishment. It either has to be so severe that the person remembers it and fear will not make them do this again, like the Muslim law, or it has to be a follow-up. I mean, it has to be just somebody locking away is no sense. There has to be a rehabilitation.
It has to be part of a larger process.
I think it cannot be. I think what we have is too much indifferent punishment. People are just locked away and there's no follow-up.
Okay, well, using that as a bridge, I want to explain, as I best understand it, what the philosophy of punishment is. Why do we punish criminals? What does punishing criminals accomplish? And let me say at the outset, I support punishment as a concept for dealing in criminal sentencing, among others. And I'm going to say some more about that. So I'm trying to present this in not just a negative, but at least a partly positive light, too. We punish criminals to uphold the standards of justice upon which social order and well-being depend. The punisher who's upholding the moral order by punishing someone who breaks it. That sense of satisfaction that society gets in punishing a criminal is a lesson that the rest of society learns that laws are important, that hurting other people is wrong, if we're talking about crimes of property and person and violence. And so punishment in this sense makes society better, to put it into three words. Punishment reinforces the moral values that undergird human cooperation in society. And so punishment has something to do with society. And secondly, why punish criminals? Because criminals deserve punishment. If you do something wrong, you should be held accountable for it. Punishment presupposes that the person who did the act had a choice. It says you could have done this or not done this. You chose to do it. Now you have to be accountable for what you've done. It presupposes free will, moral autonomy, and so on. And so it holds persons morally accountable for their actions. And so you punish people, criminals, because they deserve it. And secondly, thirdly, and sort of a variation on that, punishment is just deserts, in the sense that punishment should be proportional to the crime committed. There's something to an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. Not that we're going to go out blinding people, and I just had a crown put in my mouth recently, so I certainly don't want to have teeth taken out of people. That's not a pleasant process. Although if somebody bashed in my tooth, I'm not sure what the best response would be. But a proportionality, so that, as you were saying, Jenny, that when an action is committed, there's a consequence that is predictable and proportionate and follows from what that action is. And parents disciplining children is an example. And the fourth point, then, is that prison is an appropriate punishment in a society based on freedom. There may be other punishments which are more appropriate for other societies based on other fundamental values, but where freedom is so important, imprisonment is a particularly severe and strong form of punishment. It has a number of advantages, as well as having to do with our fundamental values. One is that it can be proportional. You can give a 2-year sentence or a 10-year sentence or a 50-year sentence according to the severity of a crime. It's a specific deterrent, or it incapacitates, in that the person, while in prison, at least is not going to be out there committing further crimes on the street. And thirdly, it's also a general deterrent, in that prison is sufficiently awful an experience that people will try to avoid doing things that will get them in there. Whether that just means avoiding getting caught or actually avoiding committing crimes is an important question.
On the last point, that theory is at work. The people, get, when they're put in jail, what's the statistic on how many people when they come out of jail don't do something?
Yeah. Recidivism is terribly high, and that's
they
a good argument.
They just sit there and get angry and fight about revenge, and when they get out, that's all they can do.
become criminals in prison.
Well, I was surprised our first day when we talked about the sources of crimes that nobody put prison on the board as a source of crimes. Because prison is, in a sense, a school for crime, more than an answer to it. Although the great irony, what do we call our prisons?
What's corrections.
Corrections, what's an even more religious word that we use for some of them? Penitentiary.
Yeah.
It's your place to repent. And prisons were invented by Quakers in the late 1700s as a humane alternative to executing people for pickpocketing and so on. Even the smallest crimes of property led to the death penalty. And so prisons were thought to be these moral reformatories, these places to repent. You were put essentially like a room in Lodge 4. I mean, you had a small room, a bed, a sink. I don't know if are there sinks in the lodge rooms? A sink and a Bible. And that's where you were, and your meals were brought to you, and you were supposed to think about what you had done and be led to repent for your actions.
They don't that's think what that way. Maybe when they get sent to the room, like the kid sent to his room, all he does is think of how he hates his mother for a while or something like that. He's sitting
yeah.
Without dinner.
Go ahead over here.
I think we can look at statistics that show that people in prison often go back to prison and say it's not a deterrent, but I think that we don't have statistics showing how many people do not do crimes because of the threat of prison.
Yeah.
You can't find those stats because they aren't there.
Precisely, precisely. And that's where you have to take statistics with a grain of salt, because that only shows you what, statistics only show you what happens. They don't show you what don't happen. And we could do, use that as a key to unlock a whole session on what statistics are and aren't. But just think, for example, what you do. I don't know how many of you, like me, drive about 62 when you're out on the highway, because I've heard that they start picking people up at 63. So if it was really 55, I'd probably drive 55. Although, I'd take the chance if I was in a particular hurry of going a little faster. But when I'm going 62 and I see a police car up ahead, I'm still going to slow down, because one, I don't want to get caught and pay the fine. But there's a kind of a gut level reaction that goes deeper than that. There's a fear of punishment that runs deep in the gut of each of us. At least in a sense it ought to, if we've had a good upbringing, because the punishment... I'm going to get myself in trouble if I continue that sentence. There's a fear of punishment that runs deep in all of us, and call it the law, if we're going to use Lutheran theology. And in that sense it ought to, because we all stand convicted. So the fourth reason why you punish criminals is because it plays into and ties into the deep fear of punishment, which is part of human nature, and you could give a theological justification for that. So, I've laid out why we should punish criminals, we've already started raising some objections, and I want to raise some more now, but I want to put it in perspective with the four goals of criminal sentencing. As they're generally accepted in the courts. I can't ever get this thing to work right.
I can't read that. Is there a black or should
I try
again?
So
we get contrast.
Yeah. The line is
nice. Was that?
No.
Four goals of criminal sentencing.
Can't see it.
Can't see it?
No.
Maybe this isn't going to do any good. That's good. I'll learn how to use this. Yeah. The first is what we're talking about, and the fancy word is retribution. These are the values of the goals of criminal sentencing upheld by the Supreme Court and generally used by criminologists and state legislatures and so on. And to the extent that punishment is one of these goals, this is where it comes in. But it's not the only one, unlike what's our kind of general philosophy these days. The second is incapacitation, and that's why prison is particularly used, especially for people who are considered dangerous, who are considered threats to others in society. They need to be incapacitated, prevented at least for a time from doing it to others. And the people who are the most dangerous need to be kept away for the longest time. In the state of Michigan, we have a mandatory sentence of life in prison without parole for first-degree murder. There's not a whole lot of first-degree murder convictions because juries don't like to do that to people, although in a lot of cases they do, serious cases. The only way you can get out of prison is if the governor commutes your sentence. And for first-degree murder, there may be something to that. I'd like to see a little more leniency. I'd like to see the possibility of parole at a certain point. But there are dangerous, lethal people in our society. Maybe we meet more of them in Detroit than you do in your hometown. I bet you have your share, too. Who ought to be separated from the rest of us for as long as they're still dangerous. And determining that's difficult, but I don't want to run into them. And that's generally accepted as one of the goals of criminal sentencing. Oh boy, here I'm losing it. As much as I do this work, I still don't remember how to spell deterrence. Deterrence, general deterrence. Criminal sentencing should be such that people won't want to do what would get them into the possibility of being sentenced under it. It should deter people from committing crimes. As you were suggesting, we don't have the statistics how many people didn't commit crimes. If there was no sentence for, if it was a crime and you could be charged and convicted, but there was no sentence for speeding, if you, all you ever got was warnings, which take about, you know, 4 minutes at the side of the road, most of us would probably drive even faster than we do. But the possibility of being sentenced deters us from driving that fast. I was stopped once in the state of Montana when I was going, I'm not going to tell you how fast. But the reason, this was some years ago when I was a teenager, et cetera, et cetera. But the reason he stopped me was to give me a warning, to tell me I was getting close to the Idaho and then the Washington border. And if I was going that fast in Washington, they would sock me with a $100 fine. He said, in Montana, we don't really, you know, particularly care if you drive too fast. Because this is such a wide state, everybody drives that fast. But you better not do that in the next state. So he was warning me about the deterrence that was ahead. Excuse me?
I said that was gentle justice.
Was it justice? It was gentle. If that's justice, well, it was gentle mercy. I'd agree with that. The fourth goal of criminal sentencing, which is still officially on the books but is not quite so popular these days, is rehabilitation. And that is essentially what all our objections have been to this notion of punishment. Namely, that punishment is not person-centered enough. It doesn't take the subjective experience of the one being punished into account in the particular situation of criminal justice. And it tends to set up a kind of parental model of the state. We looked last night at how in the juvenile justice system, the state is considered the ultimate parent of every child. The system of punishment, the philosophy of punishment, carries that over to adults, in a sense. And the state becomes the ultimate parent of every adult. And many adults tend to resent that and not have the effect on the actions that's looked for. So I'd like to talk a little bit about the meaning of rehabilitation and then stretch that concept one notch further and put it in terms of reconciliation as an alternative philosophy for criminal sentencing. And then see where that leads us. The U.S. places third worldwide in imprisonment, behind the Soviet Union and South Africa. That puts us in some kind of company as imprisoners in the world. And with the overcrowding of the prisons, over half the prison system, state prison systems in the nation are under federal court orders to reduce their overcrowding and improve their conditions. With the kind of overcrowding that our prisons have, prison is not rehabilitating in any sense, but debilitating. With idleness, with riots, with mental disorders, with assaults and murders within prison, with suicide, And despite the sense that we're not being harsh enough on criminals, we're not having long enough terms, and everybody's asking for more people to be put in prison for longer periods, we've nearly doubled our imprisonment rate since the mid-1970s. We've nearly doubled our rate since the mid-1970s. But who are we putting in prison? It's chiefly, the increase is due chiefly to non-violent property offenders. So that now almost half the people in prison are there for non-violent crimes, non-violent property crimes. In the book, which puts the rehabilitation and reconciliation perspective most strongly and best, I think, it's called Crime and Reconciliation by Mark Umbright, available in our bookstore. And he says that these statistics about what's happened pose some tough questions for our criminal justice system. He says, for example, does it make sense to punish a $300 thief with $15,000 of prison punishment while the victim receives no repayment? That's about what it costs to keep someone in prison for 1 year. You give a relatively light prison term for someone who's taken your color TV out of your house, a year in prison. You don't get your color TV back, and the state spends $15,000 punishing that person. He asks, secondly, wasn't the biblical directive of an eye for an eye to bring proportionality into the justice system so that the punishment given the offender did not exceed the damage caused to the victim? And does imprisonment exceed the damage caused to the victim, particularly in the case of nonviolent property crimes? And thirdly, he asks, does it make sense to continue to pack a large volume of non-repetitive and nonviolent criminals into already overcrowded prison facilities, thereby requiring early release of violent and repetitive offenders? In Michigan, we have an early release law, which is triggered automatically. When the system reaches a certain level of overcrowding, automatically people's sentences are reduced, and the time before they're eligible for parole is reduced across the board. You put more and more property criminals in prison, and it's letting the violent ones out sooner. I don't know about your own states, if they have that kind of automatic mechanism to accomplish it. Umbright argues that we should focus more on two other words as the heart of rehabilitation, namely restitution and reconciliation. And he would like to see these accomplished in community-based alternatives to prison for nonviolent offenders. Senator Mark Hatfield has written, "Our system of corrections must allow for a healing process between the offender and the community if the offender is ever to be assimilated into the mainstream of society." What healing process happens when a person is put in prison for a year, for 3 years, for 5 years? What happens when they come back into the community? They look for the person who got them there, and so on. Not necessarily. Many people come out of prison and lead lives that we should emulate. But in some cases, that healing process does not happen. Umbright outlines a program which is a model of restitution and reconciliation, and I'd like us to take a couple minutes to consider what this program looks like. It's called VORP. I'm not going to write that up there. VORP, which stands for Victim Offender Reconciliation Program. And he says, the most direct and intensive manner in which reconciliation can be worked at is through a face-to-face meeting between the victim and the offender. In this context, the criminal act becomes personalized as both victim and offender deal with each other as people rather than as stereotypes. What happens in the victim-offender reconciliation program, first thing, it's entirely voluntary. It depends on a person pleading guilty to their crime, which is generally a nonviolent property crime, although they occasionally will take violent crimes, but not very often. And the victim agreeing that this will be resolved in a face-to-face meeting, and the offender agreeing to meet face-to-face with their victim, together with a trained mediator through the VORP program. So first the mediator goes and meets with both of them, then they all meet together, and when they meet face-to-face, let me read this, if the victim and offender agree to meet, the volunteer sets and facilitates a meeting where the case is discussed, restitution is negotiated, and a contract signed stating the nature and amount of restitution agreed to. If they've taken your color TV set, you as the victim may agree that what needs to be done is they need to provide you with a new color television set, or the money equivalent of a new color television set, to provide restitution for what they've done. So there's a specific contract, and then the terms of that contract are followed through by the VORP program, and a contract which is not carried through by the offender is sent back into the prison, and they can still into the court, and they can still receive a prison sentence if they don't carry out the terms. The second thing that it does, as well as provide direct restitution for the victim, is provide the opportunity for the victim to ask questions. Why me? How did you get into the house? Is there anything I could have done to prevent it? Why did you spray paint the walls, or why did you crush our kids' toys when what you really wanted was the color television? A chance to ask those kinds of questions that you feel as a victim, face to face with the offender, and hopefully feel some sense of connection and receive some kinds of answers to what your experience has been. It's also beneficial to the offender. One thing you get to avoid the prison term, which is something most offenders want to do. But for another, it engages the humanity of the offender, and they see face to face the consequence of their actions. And maybe it's a more powerful form of accountability to meet your victim face to face than to sit punished in prison for a year or whatever. So there's benefits to the victim and to the offender. And Umbright concludes, nobody connected with the victim-offender reconciliation process can leave that experience without being moved by the creative power of reconciliation in human conflict. He sees a crime not as an objective, the state versus the people of Ohio versus Johnson, but he sees crimes as occasions of human conflict between human beings that need to be resolved by means of conflict resolution in human terms, face to face. And so this is now, they've dealt with thousands of offenders. It started in Elkhart, Indiana, largely through the work of the Mennonites. He says there's programs in Minneapolis, in Seattle, and in 40-some cities around the country that can work with VORP. So that's another model. Go ahead.
Could they give them their television back? You mentioned, whether they'd have to give them money for that. But I was thinking of a teenager who might have gotten involved like that.
Mm-hmm.
There really would be, there might not be any money really involved in that situation.
Mm-hmm.
If the person would, if it was not harm or they hadn't sold it or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So that the cost, even to the person who did it.
They tend to be a little tougher than that in general. Let me read a case example, which Umbright quotes. He says, the offender has committed a felony home burglary under the Indiana Code. He's 18 years old and is being tried as an adult, but just barely. Four parts of the sentence. For one thing, 30 days in prison, which was the jail time awaiting trial. For a second, 180 hours of unpaid community service. For a third thing, the victim-offender reconciliation and restitution. And fourthly, 7 years of probation, where if he commits another offense, the probation could be revoked. And then he says, note, the other offender in this case, who did not agree to the VORP, received 10 years in prison from another judge.
What was the crime?
It just says a Class B felony, home burglary, so we don't know exactly.
Seems a little severe. I think the 7 year probation is a bit severe. Well, yeah. I think particularly
in the case of a teenager, does that go on his record?
Well, juvenile records are generally confidential and expunged in adult. It doesn't become a part of your adult record.
You turn 18 unless you're using an earlier series, it's usually erased.
It's usually erased.
I mean, that's good.
So, that's the idea. Generally good.
But if this 18-year-old was tried as an adult, then it would be on his record.
It would be on his record at that point. Well, that's right.
But the 10 years is ridiculous.
Well, that's Indiana. That certainly sends a message to somebody. Go ahead.
Two things. I think in Europe they deal with property crimes more on this sort of basis of reconciliation and restitution.
Mm-hmm.
And I often get involved in shoplifting things, you know, kids shoplifting.
Mm-hmm.
Their parents come running to me driving the kid. And but what we talk about and what I say is, I'll go with you and you will confront the store manager that you, from which you have taken this thing, and we'll have a little talk, you know, and face to face. And invariably, those kids don't pick up another thing.
Yeah, that's what my dad did with me when I was about 13 and took a little ink pad out of the Ole store at St. Olaf.
Oh, you did?
Yeah. I never took a thing, never shoplifted again in my life. It was a dumb thing. I had no reason for it. I don't know why I took it to this date, except it was kind of, you know, why do you rebel anyway? And we went and I returned it and I apologized and I've never taken anything in my life again.
Yeah.
But that made that direct encounter made a difference, state. Made an impact. Yeah.
That's I you should pay for article and talk with the store manager and let him talk to you.
I think he docked my allowance the amount that the thing was worth, too.
But I think Europe has more of that than property crimes, don't they?
Absolutely. They don't imprison anywhere near what we do.
But they do hold a person accountable.
Well, that's the way this, I mean, that's what's attractive about this model, is that it's a different type of accountability, but it's maybe a more powerful accountability than the let's punish them accountability. So it's two models of accountability. I'm trying to weigh here. I have down next on my outline small group discussion about the pros and cons of alternatives. Do we want to do that as a large group, or are you ready to break into small groups and go at it for a few minutes?
Large.
Stick together?
Yeah.
Okay, that's kind of my sense, but I wanted to give it an option. Here's the question I'd like us to take a couple minutes to discuss then. Do you think nonviolent property offenders should be sent to prison or sentenced to one of these forms of alternative punishment? What are the pros and the cons, so to speak, of alternative punishment? We've already been talking about this somewhat, but I'd like to set it in that kind of framework. And what do you think? Let's start here.
It appears to me that we've already got restitution built into a lot of our convictions or whatever on property crimes. Very often people that do break-ins, robberies and things will get out of prison, not go to prison, and there'll be restitution built in, and that's really hard to enforce. You know.
Well, could you give me some examples of...
Well,
I haven't seen that much of it myself.
I had my house broken into a couple of years ago by four people, and they pretty much wiped us out. And there was no, I think two of the four were on probation already.
Mm-hmm.
And they all got probation again, and they were all supposed to make restitution. And we got a little bit of money, but then the checks quit coming, and the parole officers just have too much to do. You know, they just, well, he doesn't have a job, how can he pay you?
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's really nice to say there's restitution, but it's a real follow-up problem, and we better be ready to put a lot of money into that program to enforce that. Otherwise, it's not there. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Well, the question then you have to weigh is the kind of money it takes to provide that restitution and to enforce it and to enforce probation versus the use of more prison sentences.
Yeah.
And somehow we've got this strange mentality that we're willing to throw millions and billions of dollars into prisons. And we've got this huge prison, $450 million prison construction proposal in Michigan now. And they're going to build two new prisons. And in Michigan, I'm not entirely sure we don't need it. It's a close call in Michigan. But that, I mean, $450 million, what would that do to the probation system and to the enforcement of restitution and to the funding of community-based alternatives? My gosh. But we're not willing to give those things that kind of money because somehow they're sort of beside the point of mainstream criminal justice, criminal sentencing work. So that's a problem.
One solution would be for the state to pay you the money as a restitution, and then when the person is on probation, they have to pay back because they, I think they'd be more likely.
Well, you could put, the state could have the power to put various liens on earnings and so on,
right,
to accomplish that.
If they were willing to spend $15,000 a year, they could give you the $500 for the TV or whatever it is, and then as the person has to report for probation, they make their monthly payment. And people usually, when it's the state, they don't try to back out as much as
But they're paying through the state now. That doesn't write the check out to you. It goes
to the state. But he doesn't do it.
Well, in Michigan, it's called compensation as opposed to restitution. Restitution is generally person to person. Compensation is when you have a larger kind of state insurance fund, is what that essentially is. If you get robbed, you're insured by the state for the value of what was taken. That's what the victim's compensation becomes, is a state-run insurance program, as opposed to the person-to-person restitution model. And there's you know, strengths and weaknesses to it. I'm not sure how much we need to become the insurance society in terms of every possible loss being insured against ahead of time, including having to do with the justice system. I haven't heard from you.
I expect this is related somewhat to the repeaters, that if you've got a continual repeater, you wouldn't continue to go through this type of dealing with him, that there would be more severe incarceration or whatever.
Well, one of his first case example is a 21-year-old adult with prior juvenile incarceration, with several prior juvenile convictions, including burglary, theft, and status offense, who had committed an $8,000 theft, cleaning out someone's house. Well, not, most of us have a little more than that, maybe, but that's a significant amount of theft. He received 200 hours of community service, victim offender reconciliation and restitution, substance abuse counseling, and 161 days in jail, the time he served awaiting trial. So this was a case where it was a repeat offender, but there was that counseling built into it, which is another component. I don't know enough about VORP to answer, you know, some of the details of the way it works. I'm presenting it more as a model.
I have a question for the gentleman down there. Did you have the person-to-person confrontation?
No, and that's an interesting thing. I kind of wish we would have had that. We came close, because when the grand jury or whoever was meeting with these people, we sat next to the robbers at a bench, and I thought that's who they were, but I didn't know for sure.
Yeah.
And I wish at that time we could have had this meeting with them.
I wonder how that would have impacted the case.
From both sides.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Well, going on to the next step on that, I, several years ago, was on the other end, and you talk about community service. The little bit I dealt with, I couldn't be bothered.
Yeah.
It just simply wasn't worth it. We were the recipients of the community service,
mm-hmm.
and it wasn't worth it.
It's a nice title for what?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I ended up babysitting these guys for a couple of hours,
mm-hmm.
and we certainly didn't receive anything out of it.
Mm-hmm.
The community, and I always, I see 200 hours, and I, oh my God, I got to babysit 200 hours. As the community, the group I was with, I wouldn't be bothered.
Anyone else have experiences of that sort?
Yeah.
Yeah?
It's, the fellow was an adult, and he was a teacher even, you know? But
mm-hmm.
he came to the church and asked if I would give him community service, you know? And we sat down and talked and so forth, but the community service that he rendered was awful sloppily done, you know, and he just did it in haste, and he didn't do a good job, and he just did it because he had to get that signature on. And he wasn't the kind of service you could have hired it done, and it wasn't bothered.
What I'm hearing from several of you on different parts of this point is that some of these alternatives seem to not be taken seriously,
right,
as seriously by the offenders, and doesn't seem quite proportional necessarily to what they've done. Okay, we have these alternatives and they're using nice labels like community and restitution, but is this really doing something about the crimes that were committed? That's the question here. Go ahead.
I think the offender doesn't take community service seriously because the system isn't taking community service seriously. It's just they aren't enforcing it. They aren't making sure that the work is valid or done well.
Well, that's my whole point. Somebody's got to then come along and monitor them.
Right.
And then, or somebody's got to stand over that person and enforce it. And then, so then it seems like we've got all these people involved getting that one person to pick up the trash or paint the windows or do whatever. Then all of a sudden you've got 10 people involved to see that that person does it. Right. Yeah.
Well, that sounds like the State Highway Department, four watch and one work. Go ahead. Yeah, who's being punished?
I remember when I was young, they always showed a prisoner the ball and chain with a hammer, rocks. I think that kind of community service would be a whole lot better because it would show him the utter futility of it's a
back
it's
to
a
the chain gang
punishment. I mean, not to put a chain on him, but to have him break rocks up in little pieces, show the utter futility of crime. You know.
Well, if he doesn't go crazy and commit suicide first, etc.
It's better community service than what I experienced.
It's probably as long as you've got. I mean, he still's got it. If he's got a ball and a chain and a guard with a rifle, it's going to be enforced at least, and he's going to do it.
He can do it, but in front of the courthouse.
Yeah. Well, that's how we could have had a cheaper interstate system built, I suppose. But I want to shift our discussion here to one more key point, since we're drawing to the last 5 minutes or so of our discussion. And I want to throw one more monkey wrench into here and then use that to summarize. What does what we've been saying today have to do with the death penalty? If the death penalty is the ultimate criminal sentence, the taking of someone's life, what does that have to do with the power of punishment on the one hand and the possibilities of reconciliation on the other? And do the dissatisfactions we've had with punishment mean that we ought to oppose the death penalty because it is chiefly and really only a form of retribution? Or do our dissatisfactions with the alternatives and the lack of seriousness sometimes seen in the alternatives say that what we need is a system with more teeth in it and that's got more power, and what we ought to be doing is showing the majesty of the law, as Walter Burns calls it, who's written a book for capital punishment, which I highly recommend to you, by the way, whether you support or oppose capital punishment. The majesty of the law, which can no better be heightened than by the moral spectacle of execution. What's your thought about the death penalty in this context?
Well, I think it's one way of ridding yourself of a particular individual. We talk about the expense of maintaining someone in prison for life. That's a burden on everybody you have to pay for.
Mm-hmm.
But if he's executed, that's it.
Well, the one thing that execution does better than any other sentence is incapacitation. And if you think kapos, isn't it in Greek, means head? And if you take the head off, literally, almost, with a hanging or a guillotine, you have incapacitated someone. Does that certainty overweigh the other goals? Well, that's certainly a value of capital punishment. What are some more thoughts? How does the death penalty relate to these goals?
Well, at the very beginning, we were talking about the effect on the punisher, the person who has to do the execution.
Yeah.
It's affected far more than the person who dies, because the person who dies doesn't learn anything. He just dies, or she.
Yeah.
They just die. They don't learn a lesson. They're just prevented from doing anything again.
There is no chance, like Hebrews said, but later, and those on whom it has been used, it bears fruit in peace and goodness. That, it's impossible. Well, the thief on the cross, Jesus said, today you'll be with me in paradise. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, here you're going to have to delve into human nature. What kind of a person is that person? Is he a person without conscience? Is he a person who, if you did set him free again, like I told you before,
mm-hmm. go do it again or worse?
Do it again or worse.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And,
the question, though, is who has the power to make that decision? Whether the person has a conscience or not. Does the state? Does the jury? Does a judge?
No.
Can a psychiatric expert?
His fellow citizens have that right.
His fellow citizens. So a trial by jury, which gave a death sentence, could in that case determine that.
God gave the sword to the government, right?
Well, depends on what you mean by the sword, but Paul used that word. Yeah. Well, I'm
to punish.
It clearly says that in Romans 13, and I haven't brought that out. That's for this evening when we have death penalty debate as our evening forum tonight. I'm just whetting your appetite.
Whetting our swords.
Well, I guess the best thing we can do for now is whet our appetites.
Yeah.
Let me conclude with one last shot myself. In that, why did I say I support punishment? Because there are people who need to learn through the just deserts of retribution. But for a society which these days seems to only emphasize increasingly harsh punishment, we need to say there are also other goals to criminal sentencing, including also rehabilitation. To liberals who say we only want to rehabilitate everybody, these people just need some good counseling and therapy and job training and they're not so bad anyway, and give them a chance and they're going to be okay, I say, not necessarily so.
No.
There are some of these folks that ought to be locked up for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not the case with everybody. And particularly, as VORP has shown, there are people who, when there are people who care, the thing about VORP is that it's community-based, volunteer, not in the system. They work with the system, but it's a separate organization. It doesn't ask the system to put its money into it. It's people of conscience and sincerity who work it themselves. And they make sure that it works.
So
that's why
necessarily.
They'll refer to it, but they're not the enforcers necessarily. The VORP people do it on a voluntary basis, and that's precisely its strength.
Do they have the power to make the person give retribution?
Restitution. The only leverage they have is moral leverage, and secondly, that if they don't do it, they'll send them back to court to be sentenced to prison. So it's to waive. If you're talking about a kind of cynical self-interest of the offender, it's a way of getting out of some prison time, maybe. So that's...
It's similar to the probation system.
Which is similar to probation, and it's sort of in between probation and prison, in a sense. But it's a model of what, for some people, where there needs to be flexibility in the goals of criminal sentencing, where reconciliation is possible. And what I'm also doing is upholding two different theologies here. I'm upholding a theology which talks about discipline, which talks about superior-inferior relationships, like parent-child, like God and us, in the sense of Hebrews, but also a model of human conflict in community, which says that reconciliation between human beings is God's goal for us. And so there's two different theologies, which in a sense are competitive, but I'm a kind of a dialectical or a paradoxical thinker anyway. That's probably why I'm a Lutheran. So I try to hold the two things in some kind of tension. This evening will be a forum to air our opinions on the death penalty. I wrote the capital punishment debate for the ALC, presenting both sides, and have strong feelings, and I do incline one way, but I'll save that for this evening. Thank you.